Okay, we'll start our third Italian-themed lecture. And it just seemed to me, in anticipation of our trip, that it would be a little bit funny to go to Italy and not speak at all about fashion. And the truth is, we know that fashion, aside from being an aesthetic issue, an issue of taste and beauty, but in every culture, fashion is also about identity. And sometimes, especially as Jews have lived now 2,000 years in the diaspora, the issue of fashion and Jewish identity has been one that could be very complicated. And although we'll focus primarily the thrust of the lecture on the halachos of how a Jew should be dressing living in a secular world, but just to show you how complicated things can be, especially in the modern Western world, and in particular in America, so listen to the following quote. This is from the New York Times in the end of April this year. Spotting a Borsellino, a black, wide-brimmed felt fedora, in the traditionally Jewish section of Williamsburg, Brooklyn, is no strange thing. What was surprising was the wearer, Theophilus London, a hip-hop artist from Trinidad. "This one is from the Jewish store," Mr. London said, motioning toward southern Williamsburg, where the Haredi still outnumber the hipsters. The article goes on to say how the black hat has become hip in certain non-Jewish circles. So this hip-hop artist wears it. They have a worker in the Adidas store on the Lower East Side who likes wearing it, said Monica Javeski. She likes wearing her black hat because I know it's genuine. The Jews have been wearing it for so many years. So the something that's so uniquely Jewish, we might have thought, in the modern world, has now become even not so uniquely Jewish anymore.
I'm waiting for the
tzitzis. It'll happen. Anyway, so this is just as a sense of, and if you will, how complicated these issues can be in terms of the issues of identity. But in terms of the issues of halacha, aside from fashion being kind of an Italian theme, in particular, one of the most famous responsa written in the Middle Ages in the time of the Rishonim on the issue of an issue of clothing, coincidentally or not, also happened to be from one of the great Italian Rishonim. And in order to have a background to understand this tshuva by Rav Yosef Kolon, who's known as the Maharik, who was a great Italian Rishon who lived in the middle and end of the 15th century, we need to take a step back and go to the beginning, to the Torah itself, to see how the Torah addresses issues not only about fashion, but generally of Jews being involved in non-Jewish practices. So the Torah tells us in the end of Parshas Achrimos, in Perek Yud Ches and Sefer Vayikra, that we're not supposed to be imitating certain abominable practices of our host countries. And then the Torah tells us in the three famous last words of the Pasuk, U'b'chukotehem lo telechu, that we are not supposed to be going in the chukos, in the ways of the non-Jews. And Rashi gives examples of certain cultural experiences, not even limited to dress, but broader cultural issues. So we know that there is some prohibition of imitating or of following the non-Jewish practices or ways. What is not at all clear from a pasuk and from three words is exactly why there is a problem, what are the parameters of the prohibition, and if we don't understand that, then we certainly won't understand what would be allowed. What's wrong, what's not allowed, what is allowed, what are the reasons, what are the issues? So the entire halachic discussion, since the time of the Talmud, now for many, many years, has in essence revolved around reconciling two apparently contradictory texts. The Talmud discusses this in two places, but the problem is that the Talmud, the Gemara, seems to contradict itself. And therefore we need to understand the contradiction, and we'll see the various attempts at reconciliation about the broader issue of Jewish, non-Jewish interaction. And then, in the last third of the lecture, we'll be able to dedicate our attention specifically to the issue of fashion. But more broadly, in understanding this prohibition, it's a pasuk, it's on the books, in the Chumash, how do we understand it? What is the prohibition? So the first source that addresses this is the Gemara in Masechta Avodah Zarah, number 3 on your source sheet. And the Gemara there is discussing a custom which was practiced in the Jewish, our Jewish nation in the time of the Malachim, when we had kings in Israel, which is that when a king would die, they would take his property, surf in Al Malachim, and they would burn all of his property in some kind of big public ceremony. And the Gemara here says explicitly that this is something that the non-Jewish nations would do for their kings at the same time. And therefore the Gemara is obviously bothered that this presumably should be a problem. How can we do this? After all, v'haksiv ubuchukoseihem lo teilechu. If the non-Jews are doing it, and the Pasuk says we're not supposed to do what the non-Jews do, so how can we burn the king's clothing, the king's items, the same way the non-Jews do? And the Gemara answers in the underlined part, in number 3, the second line, Ela de kuleyama sreifa lav chukahi. No, this does not violate the prohibition. Why? Because it is not a chukah, but rather chashivusa hi. Now exactly what is being contrasted is not 100% clear, we'll have to see. But one thing, the Gemara seems to be putting down a certain marker. And that is that why do we burn the king's clothing or the king's property? As a sign of his importance. It's a tribute, it's an honor to the king that no one else should be allowed to use his property. And therefore, since there seems to be a good reason for it, there's a good rationale for doing it, therefore it's permitted. Okay. So if we would just stop here, it would seem like anything where there's a good rationale, it doesn't seem likely that the only good reason to do anything in life is things that are for honor. That's one example. But more broadly, things that have a good rationale, that make sense to do it, we could do it. Other things which make less sense, you shouldn't do. However, the problem is that the second time the Talmud addresses this question, it seems to be a contradiction. Because the Gemara in Masechta Sanhedrin is actually discussing a second thing. You can throw things at your wife when she comes late to shear. The Gemara here in Masechta Sanhedrin, actually in the Mishnah, is actually discussing something completely different, but the Gemara will connect it. And that is one of the capital ways, one of the capital punishments, according to the Torah, is somehow beheading a person. Certain very serious averas, we behead the person. So there's a machlokis, this is probably not so well known, there's a machlokis in the Mishnah, in the time of the Tanaim, what is the way we behead people according to the Torah? The first opinion of the Chachamim, that the Mishnah quotes, is that they would take a sword, the Mishnah says, Hayamatizin es rosho besayif, Kederach Shamalchus Osa. Right, you've seen the movie. The guy is standing there. They take the sword, two hands, whoosh, and they chop off his head. And the Chachamim in the Mishnah say, Kederach Shamalchus. Who's the Malchus? Time of the Mishnah? We were just there. We were just there. That's the time of the Tanaim, the Roman Empire. They used to behead somebody with a knife, with the sword, I mean. However, the Gemara says the Mishnah says that Rabbi Yehuda says that is particularly cruel and degrading, and evil who? So what's the great enlightened cultured way that Rabbi Yehuda thinks we should kill people? With a guillotine. With a guillotine. Just Rabbi Yehuda says, Manichen es rosho al asadan v'kotzitz b'kupitz. And that says you lay his head down. Yeah, exactly. Maybe it's with an axe and not a thing, but you take the person, they lay their head down. Whoosh. Okay, that's the debate. That's the debate in the Mishnah. So the Gemara, when the Gemara analyzes this debate, the Gemara says that part of the issue which underlines this debate is the fact that the Chachamim admitted that the reason that they, where did they get this idea that you would just take a sword and chop off a person's head? What did we say a minute ago? Kederach Shehu, that the Malchus, that the non-Jews are doing it. So right away, Rabbi Yehuda says to the Chachamim, how could you do this? You're imitating, you're following the non-Jewish practices. Isn't that a violation of what? Ubuchukoteim lo teilechu. So the Chachamim are on the defensive. And the Chachamim give an answer. And the Chachamim say, if you look in the fourth line, this is source number 4, in the fourth line where it's underlined, V'rabanan, how come they believe this? Kaven dechsiv saif ba'oraisa. Here's the key words. Lav minayhu kagamrinan. Says the Chachamim, we're not imitating them. We're not doing what they do. It was already written in our Torah that we have to kill with the sword sometimes. And this is the way we understand that to mean. And then, bringing it back home to our original topic, the Chachamim say, we'll give you a proof. Because the Jews have a custom to burn all the clothing and the property of the Jewish king after the king dies. And you'll say, well, how could you do that? Don't the non-Jews do that also? And here, that's a direct parallel to what we saw a moment ago in the earlier piece of Talmud, in the Gemara of Avodah Zarah. But here, what does the Talmud say? What's the reason why it's allowed to burn the king's clothing? Because it's a pasuk in Yirmiyahu that says that the Jews were doing this long before the non-Jews. So too there, lav minayhu kagamrinan. We did it first, we did it on our own, it's Jewish tradition, it's Jewish culture, it's not from the non-Jews. What's the problem with this? It seems very fine on its own. The problem, as the Tosfos in source number 5 already point out, is that these two pieces of Talmud seem to contradict each other. They're both addressing either identical or similar phenomenon, and the issue, the common thread, which is really the main theme of our shir, fashion is an important example, but the bigger issue is, how do you preserve Jewish identity if you're living in a non-Jewish world? What are the halachic, I'm not discussing now, sociological, psychological, what are the halachic parameters of to what extent can we blend in, to what extent do we have to remain separate and apart? And the Gemara is addressing that question. It's a very specific example, but that's the broader context. But the Gemara here seems to be giving two different guidelines, and Tosfos points out this seems to be a contradiction. The first Talmud that we saw in Avodah Zarah number 3 said, if there's a good reason for it, chashivusahi, as long as there's a good reason for doing it, then it's allowed. But if there's not a good reason for it, then it would be prohibited. Okay, that in and of itself sounds fine. But now the Gemara Sanhedrin gave a much different and frankly more restrictive, more machmir definition. What are the things that we're allowed to do? Only things that we did first. Lav minayhu kagamrinan. We didn't get it from them. We were doing it anyway long before them. So what's the difference that they're doing it? We have our original Jewish traditions for this. That's a very different explanation. Not just different, it's much more restrictive. Imagine something that has no source in the biblical tradition, but it makes perfect sense. According to the first piece of Talmud that we saw, it would be permissible because it makes perfect sense. Anything, imagine anything. The Gemara's example here was the idea of burning the king's clothing or something else. But imagine some other thing. I don't know, to wear a button-down shirt. Makes sense. Keep warm. It's convenient to put on, put off. There's nothing in the Talmud that says you should, or in the Tanakh that talks about button-down shirts. But just say, we're doing it because it makes sense. But if you look, but according to the second text in Sanhedrin, the only things that are allowed to be done are things which we Ksiv ba'araisa, have an authentic Jewish tradition, have a Jewish source. But if it wouldn't be, then maybe it'd be prohibited. And that would be a much more restrictive definition. Yes?
I have a two-part question. First of all, in general, when in that pasuk Kamasei Eretz Mitzrayim that you started with,
yes.
I would assume that just the Peshaw, what you're talking about there is, you would never think that you're talking about every little bit of ways of life of the non-Jew. You think you're talking about they're reprehensible and moral.
Okay, good, good.
Because we know also that it says, Torah b'gayim al tami b'chachma
b'gayim. Okay, good, good.
What kind of closed minds are you? You can't do anything that a goy does.
Okay, good.
Makes no sense at all.
Okay.
They're plenty of intelligent things that they come up with.
Right.
Okay,
good. So that's 100%. So that's the issue. The pasuk itself is too way too vague. We don't know anything. That's the problem. We don't know anything from the pasuk. What you're conjecturing is plausible, but you see from the Gemara that it's not limited to something just immoral. They needed to defend the practice of burning the king's clothing. Without that defense, now we have two different defenses. But without that defense, apparently you could argue that's because that itself would be problematic because of Baal Tashchis. It's not reprehensible or immoral, but it's still...
Well, or you could argue that by burning the king's clothing, maybe somehow you're making the king into a...
Oh, deity. Good! So here's the question. This, my father is bringing up the important issue. This is the crux of the issue. And I'm going to share with you, there are more, but I'm going to share with you two different, main approaches in the Rishonim. As I said, I promised, one is from Italy. But two approaches, but the issue, the heart of it is, and perhaps I'll formulate it clearly, but I have a feeling that perhaps this is already you know, subconsciously already in your minds as you're thinking about this. The basic issue we have to ask ourselves, and this is going to open up a Pandora's box in terms of what would be prohibited or not, is, you know, what the purpose of this prohibition is to begin with, or what type of activities. Now, if I would have just asked you theoretically, I would tell you there's a prohibition of doing certain things that the Gentile, the non-Jewish world does. What parameters might a person give? So I think if you would have asked me on my own, I would have suggested that anything that they do because of avodah zarah, of idolatry, of their own religious worship, their pagan worship, so that we can't be anywhere near. Not only if we're believing in it, then it's obvious. That's the Ten Commandments. We can't worship idols. But even if we're doing something that we're doing something completely generically or quote-unquote secularly. Let's say, I'll give you as a simple example. I like a cross. It's very pretty, symmetrical. I saw a beautiful cross at one of the stores in the Vatican in Rome. I want to buy it and wear it as a necklace. So if you believe in the cross, then you don't need this lecture. That's just the first commandment. You just can't do it. You can't do that. That's obvious. But ubuchukotem lo telechu might mean, even though you don't believe in it at all, you're doing it for an aesthetic reason. But if that's something that's their religion, stay away from that. That's one possibility. Now, if we accept that, that would be a relatively narrow prohibition. Only things that relate to their religion, their pagan worship. However, one could theorize that it's something broader. That maybe it's not limited to religion. What might be a reason to prohibit things which are not even religiously based? Anyone have any ideas? So first of all, it could be, as we mentioned at the beginning of the year, the whole issue of identity. How do we preserve identity in a foreign country, right? Plus also, let me, if we do things that someone else did, what does that sound like? Think about it just in terms of, like, you know, your kids' friends or something. Imitating, that's the word I was looking for, thank you. Now what do we always tell our kids? What is imitation? The highest form of flattery. Now that's a completely different conception of the prohibition. Maybe the problem is that we're not supposed to be doing things if the reason we're doing them is trying to be like them, and that's the issue of identity. We're not discussing now idolatry, not idolatry, but you have to have a sense of Jewish identity, Jewish culture, Jewish self-confidence. Not looking to just be like them. Now this is a totally, I wouldn't say completely different, I wouldn't say they're contradictory, but they're certainly very different conceptions. And in fact, as I'll show you in a minute, the two primary approaches of the Rishonim to trying to reconcile these sources, in essence, come down to picking between these two understandings of prohibition. If you look at source number 6, Rabbeinu Nisim, who alas is only from Spain, so he gets second fiddle in today's shir. Rabbeinu Nisim, the Ran, he says the following. He says, listen, number 6. The Torah only prohibited two things. Chuko shel avodas kochavim. Anything which is known to be something that they use for idolatry. So even though you're not using it yourself for idolatry, but it's known to be idolatrous. I gave you a classic example is the cross. Or, he adds, Dvorim shel hevel ubatala, things which are pointless, senseless, silly, stupid. So you'll say, what's so wrong, what's so bad about being stupid? I know lots of people. What's so wrong about being silly, doing silly things? So this is what he says. Kulon yesh behem tzorech avodas kochavim. Ah, says the Ran. If something appears to you to have no purpose, silly, frivolous, you shouldn't do it. Why? Because we are worried that you may not realize it, but maybe its origins are pagan. I'll give you an example that's something that many of us do, which I was told actually is an example of this. When you say cheers and you clink the glasses, why do they clink the glasses? To chase away the spirits. This is what I was told by somebody who drinks a lot more than I do. Which doesn't take much. Right? L'chaim is a Jewish thing, right? The clinking the glasses. I think, again, no, you tell me, if I take any two people on this boat drinking, which would be hard to find, two people drinking on this boat, and they said, well, do they know about the spirits? Are they chasing away spirits? No, it's just what they do. We just, now it's just a silly, frivolous thing. But its origins, says the Ran, without knowing it, we're not accusing you of idolatry. That's not the point. Jews shouldn't be doing anything that makes no sense because nothing in the world has no reason. And if you think it has no reason, we have to be worried that maybe it goes back to something that's from Avodah Zarah. In essence, what is the Ran doing? The Ran says there's a contradiction between the sources. And he's picking that the primary issue is Avodah Zarah. And therefore, he says, if it's obviously Avodah Zarah, that's one thing. But even if it's got no reason, we have to be worried about it. Which is why when the Gemara in Avodah Zarah said, but there is a good reason to burn the king's clothing. We burn the king's clothing out of kavod. So we don't have to worry that there's some pagan origin, because there's an obvious, more rational reason. It's an honor of the king. The truth is that according to the halacha, and Jewish halacha has lots of things. For example, a woman who is married to the Jewish king, when he dies, is not allowed to marry anybody else afterwards. It's called Sharvit Shel Melech. We take this very seriously. The thing, right? There's certain benefit to being married to the king, but it comes at a price. You're not allowed to marry anybody else afterwards. So why? Because that preserves the honor of the king. The idea of someone else living with the woman who was married to the king, that's not b'kavodik. So here also we said, why do we burn the clothing? It's kavod. What's the purpose of kavod? It's a way of saying there's a good reason for it. It's nothing to do with Avodah Zarah. Don't worry about that. So says the Ran, you want to know what the reason? He says two things which are important for us. Number one is the Ran says there are two, on a formal level, there's two ways you could do a prohibition. One is you use something which is explicitly Avodah Zarah, and the other one is you do something which has no reason, which we're worried is Avodah Zarah. But the common thread, according to the Ran, is the prohibition is all about being worried for Avodah Zarah. Comes along the hero of our shir today, in source number 7, the Tshuvos of the Maharik. The Maharik, I'll give you the thumbnail biography. Rav Yosef Kolon, he was born in the earlier part of the 15th century. He died in 1480. He actually was born, if I'm not mistaken, outside of Italy, but he spent virtually his entire life in Italy, traveling around. At one point, I believe he was a rav in an area called Piedmont, which was in the northwestern part of Italy, which was on the border both with France and with Switzerland. He was a very, very, very important rabbinic figure in the 15th century, was considered one of the primary halachists throughout the world. In Europe, he was for sure the biggest. But even beyond that, he eventually died in Padua. We saw Padua in our lecture a few days ago. Padua was probably the most common and developed rabbinic site. Most of the rabbanim from the history of Italy, have some connection to Padua, and as a preview for coming attractions. Tomorrow, in our final lecture, which will be a lecture dedicated just to the biography, the amazing life story, and some of the thought of the Ramchal, Rav Moshe Chaim Luzzatto. So he's also from Padua. He lived a lot longer. He lived after the Maharik. He was not a student of the Maharik. But he also came from Padua. Padua was in northeastern Italy. But this was the Maharik. He was the dominant rabbinic figure in the 15th century in Italy. And you can imagine that he had many, many important writings. One of the most well-known tshuvos of this great Italian rabbinic scholar is on our question of fashion, Jewish identity, and this is what he was asked. Now, I have not done a comparative study to see if this was going on in other places in the world in the 15th century. But in his time and place, in Italy in the 15th century, they came up with the following invention: the doctor's coat. He was asked a shaila by the Jewish doctors that all of a sudden now they made a rule that you have to wear a coat. Take a look in source number 7, the first two words. Ayin Dal is an abbreviation, Al Dover. I'm being asked about what? The cape. Hakapa, the cape, which he explains what that is. It's aruka, it's long. It was a long cape, all the way to the ground. He mentions that there's no problems of tzitzis, they didn't make it with four corners. And the doctors now all had to wear this cape. So the Jewish doctors asked the Maharik, are they allowed to wear this new fashion statement? I'm sure it was very stylish, it was cut, you know, with perfect vents and Italian styling, or is that a violation of this prohibition of ubechukotei lo telechu? So using the example of the doctor's coat, he has a broader discussion. We'll bring it back to the doctor's coat in a minute. But says the Maharik, listen, he says, there's two prohibitions, two examples. The first thing he says is something which makes no sense. And he proves it, because what do we think of from this week's Parsha, Parsha's Chukas? What is a chok? Para aduma, what is a chok? Shatnez, what are these? These are mitzvahs which we don't know the reason for them. So he says here also, if you do something which, then I ask, well, why are you doing it? You know, what's the purpose of this? I don't know. You know, people are doing things. That's not a reason. You know, what's the rationale behind something? I don't know. It doesn't really make any sense. So also, now who also said that? The Ran also said you shouldn't do anything that makes no sense. But note what he says, which is different. Take a look. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 lines down. Source number 7, after the 3 dots, after the ellipse. Second word on the line. Listen to this, and I want you to tell me what's different between this and what we've seen until now. You shouldn't do anything, he says, that makes no sense. The cave and shu osa davar mishuna, you do something strange, weird, makes no sense. Asher ein bo tam nigla, there's no obvious reason to do it. Ela shehem nogin kain, because the other people around you, meaning the non-Jews, are doing it. Oz nira vadai kinimshach acharehem umodelehem. Dim lokein lama yasek kedvarim hatumum eila. It looks like, apparently, the only reason you're doing it is because you want to do what? You want to follow them. You want to be like them. After all, why else are you doing it if it isn't to want to be like them? He repeats the point later on in the piece as well. There's no, you're doing, if you take a look a few lines down, 4 or 5 lines down, he says, Af gam zos nira dahainu daf kishosa kedei lihidamos eilehem v'lo l'toeles yadua. If you're doing something for a good reason, so that's the reason you did it. And by the way, as we'll see, he says later, yofi, aesthetics, is also a reason. It's subjective, but it's also a reason. It may not be the most noble reason in the world, the most spiritual thing in life, but you're allowed to be normal. Normal people like pretty things. Yofi says it's also a reason. But if there's no reason, what's the reason you must be doing it then? Just because you want to be like them. He gives another example, by the way, which is important to mention. He says things which are pritzus. They're not sneers. They're not immodest. He says immodesty is by definition not Jewish. Part of the definition of being Jewish is to have anava and sneers, he says. So if a person is dressed, he assumes that that would be like the standard Jewish fashion, had to be by definition sneers. So anyone who is dressing that was not sneers, aside from the problem of being immodest, he says you have another thing, which is that you must be doing it just to be like the non-Jews who dress that way. But that's a whole separate part of the topic. I don't want to get into that now. He says that he adds that. He adds a chiddush. You take a look what he says inside. I don't want to. You can read it inside. I'm not going to read it now. But it's a chiddush. I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm surprised. But this is what he says. And it's very powerful. Very powerful. But the basic point here is that what is his understanding of the prohibition? The Ran, if you remember, who was only from Spain, Rabbeinu Nissim, the previous source, said, you also shouldn't do things that make no reason, that make no sense. Well, why did he say not to do it for no sense, something that makes no sense? I gave you the example of the cheers. Because he says something that makes no sense, we're worried, what? That it has some pagan origins. The Marik doesn't talk about that at all. Rav Yosef Cologne, from Italy, source number 7, he says, no, forget Avodah Zarah. That's something else, that's the Ten Commandments. That's not this prohibition, conceptually. He's in another world. He says, no, the issue is, and this is potentially more, this could be in certain ways more lenient and in certain ways more restrictive. But he says it's not about Avodah Zarah or pagan or idolatry. It's something in a certain sense more subjective, which is wanting to be like them. Imitation is the highest form of flattery, and to be perfectly frank and politically incorrect, we're not supposed to be trying to imitate the Goyim. We could be doing things the same as them. That, he says, is not a problem. But to do it just to imitate them, that's a problem. So, for example, when it comes to the coat, by the way, just for the record here, he says, there's no reason to get rid of the coat. Why? If you look 4 lines up from the bottom, he says, here, there's very good reasons for the doctors to wear the coat. He says, Tam levisha sa yedua, there's good reasons for the doctors to wear the coat. Simon heyosim mimasigim bechachma, it gives them honor and kavod, because when people see them wearing that coat, they say, this is a person who knows the business. And second of all, he says, it's good for money, machmas revach, because how are they going to know to hire? Certain someone's sick, the town doctor, they got to know, you wear the coat, they're going to know when you're sick, call the guy to come over to your house to check on the cold. If you're not wearing the coat, they're not going to know to call you, they're going to call someone else who's wearing the cape. So he says, both of these are good reasons. Again, we're not, you know, these are both good reasons, he says. A person studied, they want to have a certain distinguished prestige for all the effort they put in going to school. Again, you remember, just to remind you from the lecture we had earlier in the week, the Italian rabbinate, not just Italian citizenry, the Jewish citizenry, the Italian rabbinate had a high percentage of doctors. The medical school in Padua was frequented by many rabbinic luminaries. So it's not surprising here that he has no problem with that. On the contrary, why shouldn't a doctor have the kavod that he deserves, or she deserves? And second of all, he says, they'll be able to make a better living if they're wearing the coat. If they're not wearing the coat, who's to know, you know, there's the Indian chief, there's the accountant, there's this, and then there's the doctor. Who's going to know the difference? If you wear the coat, you'll know the difference. If you take a look on the top of the second sheet, just something I like quoting, one of the contemporary rabbinic scholars, he's actually American, but he's been living in Israel for many, many years, is Rabbi Yehuda Herzl Henkin. His grandfather was the famous, famous posek in the Lower East Side, Rabbi Yosef Eliyahu Henkin. So in his response of B'nai Barim, he has a footnote on the side where he says he saw in a letter of the Chazon Ish, and he quotes from the Chazon Ish a formulation which I love because I think that it works so perfectly with the Maharik. He has the Lashon here, I'll never forget, I read this probably 15, 16 years ago, but I've never forgotten it. He has on the second line here, what's the prohibition? Someone who is mis'ave lehidamot lahem. It's a very striking formulation, I love it. It's not just you happen to be doing something like them. What is it? Mis'aveh, mit'aveh? A desire. Someone who's filled with a desire to imitate. That's the prohibition. Yeah, it's not just a b'mikreg, you're doing the same thing as them. When I was a kid, so at some point my parents gave in and they bought me very expensive, well, not, but at the time was considered expensive sneakers. Why did I want these particular sneakers? For only one reason. Because Michael Jordan wore them. And there was a commercial. Who remembers the advertising line from the late 80s, early 90s? Oh, we go. I want to be like Mike. Well, I was one of the millions who can dunk because I got the sneakers. And I was able to jump 15 feet in the air and I made millions of dollars because I wanted to be like Michael Jordan. You know, you should know the universality of that for kids. My children are growing up in a very different way than I grew up, in a completely different country, a completely different environment. And my children are buying soccer shoes. Gutnishke Helfen, my kids are wearing soccer shoes because certain soccer stars from Europe wear such shoes. So certain things are all the same. Doesn't matter where you put the kids, they still want the same things. So that, you know, I'm not discussing it, you know, with little children, it's obviously quite innocent. I don't think it's what the Chazanish exactly had in mind, although he probably wouldn't want them wearing those sneakers anyway. In Bnei Brak, I don't think they wear these sneakers too much, except for where Avishai lives. But anyway, which is not really Bnei Brak, that's just a scam. But this is, in essence, the prohibition of the Maharik. What is interesting is if you take a look in source number 9, all of this is, you know, in a certain sense, theoretical. Bottom line, Shulchan Aruch. What's the rule? How do we paskin? What's the psak? So the Mechaber, Rav Yosef Karo, doesn't really address this so much. But especially for the Ashkenazim, what's important for us is that the Ramah, he does decide. And the Ramah has a combination psak. He combines the Ran and the Maharik. Take a look at what he says. On the one hand, says the Ramah, number one, what's prohibited? Not everything that non-Jews do, but rather things which are nogo ovde kochavim mishum pritzus. If it's immoral, and you're doing it because you want to be like those immoral people, and he gives the example, which is the traditional Talmudic example, which was in its time and place relevant, women wearing red clothing. Red clothing in the Talmud is an example that's given many times. That was known as a particular red light. It meant what it meant. It's not true anymore. No one says now a woman can't wear red clothing. But per se, red is not objectionable per se, but in the time of the Talmud, and apparently in the time of Pompeii also, for those of us who were there, it was definitely prohibited. Then he continues. He says, however, a second thing he says on the third line is something that has no reason. Ein tam b'davar. Why? Ikal emeichash mishum darche amore, mishum shemetz avodas kochavim. You don't realize it, but maybe its origins are pagan, maybe its origins are idolatrous. Now, who's that based on? Which opinion? Rabbeinu Nisim. Exactly. Very good. Hey. However, he says, something that's being done for a good reason. For example, he says, Kol mishu rofe mumcha, a doctor. Sheish bo malbush miyucha, they have a special doctor's coat. Sheniker bo shu rofe umans, everyone should know this is an expert doctor. Mutal vosho, kevin mishum osim mishum kovod, otam acher, which we know from the Arik meant money, is mutter. So there he's clearly paskening like who? The Marik. He gives the example of the Italian doctor's coat. So the Ramah, it's interesting. I found this to be somewhat curious, because when I read these sources, I think there's a very different approaches. But the Rama, at least, on some level, reconciles them. And in essence, is saying, listen, if you're doing something for a good reason, so then that's permissible. If you're doing something just to imitate, or you're doing something because it has idolatrous origins, then that becomes prohibited. Now, before we move to the issue of fashion, which we'll spend the last 15, 20 minutes on, just the issue of fashion in particular, but I have to mention one last thing to end section one of the shir, which is here, number 10, the Vilna Gaon. For those of you who may be familiar, and for those of you who aren't, it's just interesting to know, the Vilna Gaon, aside from being a genius, but he was also an incredibly original and self-assured commentator, independent thinking, meaning that he had no problem, in many cases, arguing on all of the earlier authorities. Usually we have a tradition in halacha that unless there's a broad consensus, the more recent authorities kind of accept the premises of those who came before them. But the Vilna Gaon was one of those great titans of Jewish history for whom time and place didn't really matter. And it didn't matter where and when he lived, he could argue on anybody. So the Vilna Gaon, he's also a very difficult person to read, very cryptic, hard text. He takes a survey of this whole topic, which I've conveniently offered you in an easy-to-understand English. But he, in a very difficult cryptic rabbinic Hebrew, surveys the whole topic, and he finds every opinion wanting. The Ran is no good, the Marik is no good, other opinions I didn't even tell you about are no good. Nobody's good. Why? Because we started off the lecture with two opposing sources. And his main thrust of criticism is that all of the people we've seen until now, they're basically picking and choosing. One of the rabbinic sources, one of the Talmudic sources over another. But says the Vilna Gaon, he wants to have his cake and eat it too, and not just because he's on a cruise and you can eat all you could eat. He says, I want to have my cake and eat it too. If you have a theory, he says, it has to be able to reconcile both the first source we saw in the Gemara of Avodah Zarah and the second source we saw in the Gemara in Sanhedrin. He says, we have to find one theory that can unify all of the Gemaras. What's his theory? It's a very creative theory, but very hard to understand and even harder implement. The Vilna Gaon says, if you look at the second line in source number 10, after the three dots, Kol dover shehayinu osin zulasam mutter. For example, in clothing. Aval kol shelov shin malbush hamiyuchad lehem aser. He has the following theory, the following definition. It says, it has to be something that either we thought of on our own, or we could have thought of on our own. My father asked before, just because they did something else, they have good ideas. So says the Vilna Gaon, of course they could have good ideas. We can't think of everything. But had we had enough time, would we have thought of it? Then it's okay that they thought of it first. We would have thought of it. We just didn't because they beat us to it. Okay, we can admit that. They beat us to it, no problem. But it makes enough sense, enough Yiddish cups, eventually we would have figured it out. But something we would never have done, and the only reason we're doing it is because of them, that is a prohibition. Therefore, he said, both Talmudic texts make sense. Either it's allowed because it's already written in the Chumash, or in the Navi. So then, that, obviously, we thought of it on our own. It's already in the Chumash. It's already in the Navi. Or we said the first text was, Lav chukahi chashivusahi, right? Burning the king's clothing, it makes sense. It's for kavod. So says the Vilna Gaon, it doesn't matter if the non-Jews did it first or we did it first. Even if they did it first. But it makes sense, Taka. You want to show honor to the king? Even after he dies in a monarchical society, it's a very important thing. Therefore, it makes sense. We would have thought of it on our own. Maybe we got it from them, but that doesn't matter. Because we would have thought of it on our own. That's a way of show. After all, we have other halachos, as I mentioned before, about the wives of the king. We have other halachos to show honor to the king and exclusivity to his property. So we would have thought of this one too. Burn his clothing. We would have thought of it. But something we never would have thought of, whether it's because it makes no sense, or because it's immoral, or because it's we never would have thought of it. So the only reason we're doing it is because they're doing it. That becomes prohibited. Now, the problem with this is, number one, is he's the first to admit to you that he has no precedent. He destroyed all the precedents, he knocked them down so he could have his own theory. So if we take a step back, you know, we might be a little bit more conservative and a little bit nervous to disagree with everyone who came before him. But the bigger problem with the Vilna Gaon's theory is, it's almost impossible to implement. Every time we have a new thing, we're going to have to try to figure out. You know, it could be like a running cliche, you know, put four rabbis in a room, who would figure something, you know, how do you know it? We would have guessed and we wouldn't have figured out. I'll give you just as one example where this comes up. the chief rabbi of Yerushalayim a generation ago, maybe you remember, Rav Zsolti. Zechron Levrach, remember him? Rav Bezalel Zsolti was the great chief rabbi of Yerushalayim, earlier part of the founding of the state of Israel. He was one of the people who was asked about military funerals. When Israeli soldiers, Nebuch, would die in the line of in action, so a Jew, if he's a religious soldier, so they'll let you have a religious ceremony like anybody else who's religious. But if it was a secular Jew, got it? So if the family wanted, or they just said to the army, do whatever you want. So the Israeli army, which was a new army, it's only 60 years old, they adopted the practices that were common in every other army. What does that mean? 12-gun salute, they shoot in the air. Now one thing's for sure, das ist nicht der jiddische Minig. Right? Not in Italy, not in Poland, not in Litva, not in Russia. Right? There was no Jewish army for 2,000 years. They certainly weren't shooting in the air. Where did they get it from? Of course they got it from the non-Jews. So that became a question, is that usher or not? So if Zsolti, for example, he goes through everything, and he says, well, according to all the other opinions, it should be permissible. Because even though it's not a Jewish tradition, for sure not, but you're not doing it for idolatrous reasons, that's obvious, and it's not pointless. It's a way of showing honor. Now, it's not traditional, that's for sure it's not traditional, but it's still, you're doing it, if you ask the army, why are you doing it? To show kavod, to show respect. Army, he's thinking in terms of guns, they shoot. So he says, according to all the other opinions, it should be mutter. But says of Zsolti, he thinks that according to the Vilna Gaon, it would be usser. He says, because a Jew would never have thought of this on her own. Why? Because the Jewish tradition has thousands of years of mourning rituals. We know how to do funerals. We know how to do... And by the way, P.S., I'll just digress for a second. This is one of the things I can say with confidence. We do better than the non-Jews. The whole Shiva and Shloshim, our whole mourning structure, is not only, do we believe, spiritual. It's therapeutic, it's pastoral, it's psychologically brilliant. Plus, we have Yahrzeit candles, we have Tehillim, we have a whole, we have open up of rituals and customs. You would have given, the Jews in a million years would never have thought of also shooting off guns. We would have an army, that's a different story. He's not against the army, God forbid. He's just saying, it's debatable. I'm not saying he's right. I'm just saying that's someone who was trying to figure out how to implement this statement of the Vilna Gaon. So he thought it should be prohibited. But for the most part, I'm telling you, this is not the consensus. The consensus is not to accept this Vilna Gaon, either because he was too revolutionary, and all the other earlier authorities didn't agree with him, or B, not everyone is so confident that they can guess what Jews would have figured out, what they wouldn't have figured out. And therefore, they leave that as is. Hold on, okay. Whether I finish the shiur or not, you'll still be rocking. So it's good we still have 10 more minutes where you could sit, because once I finish the shiur, you'll have to get up, and then you might fall. So, good. We have 10 more minutes, and I want to conclude the lecture now. We have this background. You understand the basic issue is issues of worrying maybe there's some avodah zarah, or the idea of just imitation, l'shem mitzvahs imitation. That's prohibited. But just because you like something, because you went to the store and it was fashionable, that does not seem to be a problem based on what we're seeing. So let's spend the last 10 minutes just focusing exclusively on this issue, the issue of fashion, in light of everything we've seen, the issue of fashion in halacha. What's interesting is that many of us, or our children, in elementary school, are taught a medrash about the time that the Jews went down to Egypt. The medrash says that they didn't change. Now what's interesting, I have to tell you, everyone knows where I'm going. I will save you the effort. You can impress your rabbis and friends at home with the following information. You can look high. You can look long. You can look far. You can use a computer-generated search engine. You will never find the medrash they taught you in elementary school, because it doesn't exist. The medrash that we all were taught is that in the zechus of three things, the Jewish people were saved from Egypt. Shalosh shinu es shmam, they didn't change their names. Shalosh shinu es lishonam, they didn't change their language. Velo shinu es malbusham. In one order or another, in every Jewish day school in the world, kids are being taught that. I was taught that. So when I was preparing this lecture, I'm giving you now the behind the scenes. I wanted to put it on the source sheet. And I was looking and I couldn't find it. I was a little embarrassed. Isn't it like Rashi? It's got to be somewhere. I've been saying it for years. My kids even, I could have asked my 4-year-old son. He would have told me the same thing. So then I went onto the computer and I did a search. I couldn't find it anywhere. I tried different, you know, algorithms. I was ready to call up the people from the Mossad, and maybe they knew where this medrash was hiding. I couldn't find it anywhere. And then I was able to then I found a version of it, which I'll show you in 1 second. But one thing for sure I found. Rav Menachem Mendel Kasher, Zachron Lavracha, who was a great encyclopedic genius, wrote many, 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 many things. Rav Kasher and his Torah Shlema, which was, he collected without computers, as we lived before there was computers and search engines and CD-ROMs, he collected on every pasuk in the Chumash, every medrash, every statement of the rabbis and chazal anywhere. He was an encyclopedic genius. So he, in the back of his book on Shmos, he points out that if you look in some of the Rishonim, they do quote some form of this medrash, but he says it's not extant. Any known text of medrash that exists in the world in the 20th century does not have this medrash. It does not exist. Now, what does exist, now that in time, you will blow the socks off your rabbis, let alone your friends, when you tell them that. Mm-hmm. Ask them to find you that medrash, which they've been quoting at their Haggadahs for 30 years. At their Seders, I mean, for 30 years. It doesn't exist. What does exist is something a little different. The same theme, but still different. If you take a look, I did find the one version of it that does exist. Source number 13. A much more esoteric source. Also a medrash from the same rabbinic time period. The Psikta Zutrasa. This completely different text, though. He says there's four things that were. We know the four cups because of the four Lashonos Shel Geula, the four terms of redemption. So according to this medrash, the four terms of redemption correspond to four things that we had merit. And one of the four is, he doesn't give all of them. I didn't put all of them on the sheet for you. But one of the four is, he says, V'lo chilfu es simlosum. They didn't change their clothes. So this idea does exist in some form in the rabbinic tradition, but it is not nearly as mainstream as you were taught, and it's actually a completely different text than people are typically taught. So now you know. You've discovered something on this trip. One of the more recent, earlier 20th century, rabbinic commentaries, who actually also does mention this, was the Meshech Chachma. The Meshech Chachma is Rav Meir Simcha of Dvinsk. He's a great, great rabbinic figure. Anyone who has any connection to Elizabeth, New Jersey, so Rabbi Teitz was a student of the Meshech Chachma, was involved in some of his publishing, his writings. Rav Meir Simcha of Dvinsk was a legendary rabbinic figure, and his commentary on the Torah, Meshech Chachma, is a modern classic. And he mentions this tradition, and he says, you should know, getting back to the beginning of our lecture, it's not a coincidence, because he says, Yaakov Avinu, Jacob our forefather, he knew with divine inspiration, with Ruach HaKodesh, that his children were going to go down into Egypt, and they're going to be there for a long, long while. And therefore, before they went down, he says, before he died, he commanded his children, if you should ever be stuck there, make sure to keep the following few things. Not because they were innately holy, but because he was sharp enough, he understood, he intuited, that a nation that keeps its language, that keeps its names, and keeps its clothing, will keep its identity. So the Meshech Chachma here makes a very strong statement, that the Jew, not only that in Egypt that they kept their own clothing, but he says for all history we have to learn this lesson. If we start dressing like them, we will assimilate, and soon there won't be an us, there will just be a them. So he takes a strong position, and he does have some sources to back him up, that whether it's technically prohibited or not, we should be careful when we think about Jewish identity not to be so assimilated. However, you should know there are other sources that, at least when it comes to the issue of clothing, are much more liberal, for lack of a better word. For example, there's a medrash, so to speak, or a teaching of the Gaonim. The Gaonim go back, before the even Rishonim. We're talking about over 1,000 years ago. The Gaonim make a point, not exactly our topic, but it's a basic point. And basically, the Gaonim say, listen, the halacha is going to be impacted based on where we live. Kol dover sha'anoshim shel osu hamakum shein osin oso mutarim gam la'anoshim yisharim hadaram b'neihem. When we want to figure out certain types of clothing, is this men's clothing or women's clothing? It's considered acceptable or not acceptable. Says the Otzer HaGaonim, very simple. People are going to dress based on the time and place that they live in. If they're living in Baghdad in the Middle Ages, they're going to dress that way. If they're living in Poland in the 20th century, they're going to dress that way. If they're living in America in the 21st century, they're going to dress that way. Now, he's not saying, for example, that there's no halachos of tznius, or he's not saying you can wear shatnez, or all sorts of other rules. He's not abrogating them. But on anything that's what we would call gray or parv, we don't have to be different just to be different. We can dress the way other people do. And the one who says this the most, most clearly, once again, is our hero, the Maharik, top of the third page. Just give me 5 more minutes and we'll be done. The Marik, again, Rav Yosef Kolon, 15th century Italy. He's the one who gave the big psak about the doctor's coat. But not only did he say that it was permissible for the doctors to wear their coat, because, you know, that wouldn't affect most of us, not a doctor, but he says something broader. He makes a larger principle. If you look at the end of the second line, he says, Ein ha-Yisrael mechuyav lihishtanos minagoy klal. There's no need for a Jew to dress any differently. Again, he's speaking within the parameters, obviously, of tznius, etc. But there's no need for a Jew to dress differently than a non-Jew at all. Ha'ikar rak shlo yihamalbush miyuchalem. You have to understand, we have to understand a historical context. There was a time in world history, and certainly in Jewish history, where there were certain types or fashions of clothing which were known to be, this is the way the non-Jews uniquely dress, and this is the way the Jews uniquely dress. In such a culture, where certain clothing was known to be uniquely Gentile clothing, for a Jew to all of a sudden wear that, even if there was nothing else wrong with it, but that alone, for the Marik, is a problem. Because then, why are you doing it? Because you want to be like them. You're trying to assimilate. And one of the quick ways to assimilate is to start dressing in a way that's uniquely theirs. But if there's a fashion which is not uniquely theirs, not uniquely ours, it's just a question of randomly. You're going to go into the store. How are you going to dress? So do you have to go into the store looking and say, I want to go to the teller. What is the thing that is sold the least this season? No one is wearing it. I don't want to wear dress. I want to wear something that no one else is going to wear. That's what I want to wear. Says, no, says the Marik, you have to be a Meshugana. He has a very profound and impacting statement, he says. Ein ha-Yisrael mechuyav lishtaras menagoy klal. Per se, there's no need for a Jew to dress differently. We have to dress modestly. We have to dress, of course, that's a given. And if it is the case that everything you go into the store and everything is immodest, then we have then you're going to have to dress differently. But not per se, it's not different to be different. It's that we have our values. But within our values, within that range, as long as something is in that range of legitimate and, you know, basically a modest clothing, men or women, so then it doesn't have to be different, it can be the same. The one who makes this point, and this will conclude, the one who makes this point in the modern era, again, the Marik is living at the end of the Middle Ages, the one who makes this in the modern era in a very sharp way is Rav Moshe Feinstein. Moshe Feinstein was asked a shaila here in his Tshuvos of Igros Moshe, and he, first of all, he tells us we don't have to worry about the Vilna Gaon, in essence, that the Maharik, Rav Yosef Kolon, our hero from Italy, that he's the main dominant approach. And you shouldn't be doing things just to be like them. And of course we shouldn't be doing things that are immodest. But he says anything that is not prohibited for one of those two reasons is just automatically permissible. No problem. Which is what we've been saying until now. Unlike Rav Zsolti, who was worried about the Vilna Gaon, or Moshe Feinstein, he's not worried about the Vilna Gaon. That's not mainstream. Fine. But then, midway through, here's the kicker. This is why pretty much almost anything you would want to wear should be permissible. Notwithstanding the greater issues, of course, we want to make sure we don't assimilate. But take a look about 10 lines down. Right in the middle, where I have it underlined, starting at the end of the line. The three words from the end of the line after the three dots, after the ellipse. Right in the middle, v'gam belozeh, or gam belavzeh. Says, leave aside everything we've been doing in the lecture until now. That's all nice, good, academic fun. But bottom line, tachlis, he says, ein shayich iser malbushe nachrim. Nowadays, he's living, of course, he's writing in the 20th century. There's no concept, it's not shayich, to prohibit Jews from wearing clothing which are, quote, Gentile clothing. Because who's to say what's a Gentile clothing, what's a Jewish clothing? We're all wearing the same clothing, he says. Imk ni omer shehem mabushe nachrim, v'yisraelim lovshin bekan mabushehem. Who's to say that this suit, this dress, this blouse is a Gentile clothing that I, the Jew, am wearing? On the contrary, he says, Badulo Nema, we should just say the opposite. Shemitchila Heim Gama Bushe Yisrael. From the outset, from when this skirt, this dress, this suit, this tie, was from the moment it was designed, was the designer thinking, I want only the non-Jews to wear this? Only if you don't want to make a good living. Of course not. He has everybody in mind. Jew, non-Jew, blue, green, yellow. He wants everyone to buy his clothing. They have in mind, so from the beginning, this is not uniquely Gentile clothing. This is Jewish clothing. The lo nikva klal mitchil anachem was never set aside. This is the non-Jews clothing, the Gentile clothing. V'achakach gam l'Yisraelim, and only afterwards the Jews wanted. No! D'michilo hayunase gam l'Yisraelim, and therefore says the Rav Moshe Feinstein, even the Vilna Gaon will permit you to dress in a modern culture, in a modern fashion. Because it's not a question of who thought of it or not. It was done for everyone at the same time. It's not, no one decided to come up with a three-button suit just for the non-Jews, and then the Jew went into Brooks Brothers and he says, oh, I want to be like them. It was made for us just as much as it was for them from the beginning. And I would add, he does not say this, but I would add, when you add to the fact that a very high percentage of the designers themselves are Jewish, unfortunately they're very far from tradition most of the time, but still, if a Jewish designer, Ralph Lauren, who at least for those in America, is arguably the single most impactful Jewish fashion designer in the last 50 years, and $13.5 billion a year in sales is enough to prove that, who's very, of course, as you know, his name was Ralph Lifshitz, went to Yeshiva Day School when he was younger because his mother wanted him to go to day school. So, when he's designing clothing, what's to make that a Jewish clothing, a Gentile clothing versus a non-Jewish clothing? Again, if there's a particular line of wear, I don't care who the designer is, that's not modest, that's not for a nice Jewish boy or girl, that's a separate issue. But something that's basically modest and otherwise tasteful. So says Rav Moshe Feinstein, it was made for Jews just as much as for non-Jews. And we would add, it was made by Jews. So on what grounds would you possibly prohibit it? So I would just add, again, I think that on a technical halachic level, what Moshe is saying is compelling, and it's obvious, and I think it's important that we, you know, most of us, I'm looking around the room, seem to be following that. However, I would just add, and with this will conclude, the larger issues that we mentioned, going back to Egypt or earlier of Jewish history, are ones that we shouldn't forget. There's no question about it that the more common our dress is, like everything else, the more prone we are potentially to the risks of assimilation. So if we're going to dress and move freely in a non-Jewish culture, then I think we have to, in our own minds, be very vigilant, and certainly in other areas of life and in other ways, make sure for us, for our children, for our grandchildren, that that Jewish identity is preserved. Whether one has to be exclusively different in our dress, so we have argued in this lecture that one does not have to, and that one can go shopping just as much in Milan as in Mea Shearim. I personally prefer Milan. But we could understand, whatever the halachic arguments are not, you understand why in Mea Shearim they dress that way. It's not necessarily for halachic reasons. But that's one way, I guarantee you, to keep your identity. Right? Everyone knows you're different when you dress that way. And there is, on some level, we should not forget what the Meshech Chachma said, that there is on some level, right, we are, why Avraham was called Avraham HaIvri, because Kola Olam Be'Ever Echad Uhu Be'Ever Hasheni. From the beginning of the dawn of our time, Avraham was different, and we're different. And we're an Am Levadad Yishkon, right? The UN will never let us forget that, trust me. Neither will the President of America, lots of people won't let us forget that. Most importantly, we can't forget that. We have to remember that we're different, and we shouldn't think that we or our children are going to automatically know that. That has to be taught, that has to be reinforced with behavior, etc. But fundamentally, when it comes to clothing, do we have to be different just for the sake of being different? So here, again, we end with the same words of our Italian hero, the Marik. Ein ha-Yisrael mechuyev lihishtanos menagoy klal. We don't have to be different just for the sake of being different. We can be involved, we can be assimilated in that sense, professionally, culturally, as long as we make sure, halachically, and even more importantly, in terms of our Jewish identity, we remember our differences and our values. But on these external things, there's certainly a lot of flexibility for finding the yofi in the outside world and co-opting it for ourselves as well. A good Arab Shabbos.